her blankly. "Come now, darling, we have a past, you and I."
"The past is the past, Sarah. You're an outsider now. Besides, you'll know soon enough."
"At least tell me where it was."
"You wouldn't believe me."
"Wherever it was, it must have been awful. You look like hell."
"The ending was messy."
"Anyone get hurt?"
"Only the bad guys."
"How many?"
"Lots."
"But the operation was a success?"
"One for the books," said Mikhail.
The high-tech office blocks had given way to the affluent northern Tel Aviv suburb of Herzliya. Mikhail was reading something on his mobile phone. He looked bored, his default expression.
"Do give her my best," said Sarah archly.
Mikhail returned the phone to his jacket pocket. "Tell me something, Mikhail. Why did you really volunteer to bring me in?"
"I wanted a word with you in private."
"Why?"
"So I could apologize for the way it turns."
"And are you happy now?"
"Very." She was surprised at how badly his answer wounded her. "Perhaps we should change the subject," suggested Mikhail.
"Yes, let's. What shall we talk about?"
"The reason you're here."
"Sorry, but I can't discuss it with anyone but Gabriel. Besides," said Sarah playfully, "I have a feeling you'll know soon enough."
They had reached the southern fringes of Netanya. The tall white apartment houses lining the beach reminded Sarah of Khan. Mikhail spoke a few words in Hebrew to the driver. A moment later, they stopped at the edge of a broad esplanade. Mikhail pointed toward a dilapidated hotel.
"That's where the Passover massacre happened, back in 2002. 30 dead, 140 wounded.
"Is there any place in this country that hasn't been bombed?"
"I told you, life isn't so easy here."
Mikhail nodded toward the esplanade.
"Take a walk,"
he approached with a slight limp.
"Sarid. Sarid. Sarid."
Dina kissed Sarah on both cheeks.
"Welcome to the Israeli Riviera."
"Is everyone here French?"
"Not everyone, but more are coming every day."
Dina pointed toward the far end of the square.
"There's a little place called La Brioche right over there. I recommend the pain au chocolat.
They're the best in Israel."
"Order enough for two."
Sarah walked to the cafe. She made a few moments of small talk in fluent French with the woman behind the counter before ordering an assortment of pastries and two coffees, a café crème, and an espresso.
"Sit anywhere you like, someone will bring your order."
Sarah went outside. Several tables stood along the edge of the square. At one sat Mikhail. He caught Sarah's eye and nodded toward the man of late middle age, sitting alone. He wore a dark gray suit and white dress shirt. His face was long and narrow at the chin, with wide cheekbones, and a smile took Rebecca Manning from Dulles Airport to London. Rebecca Manning was the former MI6 head of station in Washington. She now reported for work each morning at Moscow Center, headquarters of the SVR, Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service.
"There was also a suggestion," Sarah went on, "that you were the one who killed those three Russian agents they found on the CNO Canal in Maryland."
A waiter appeared with their order. He placed the espresso in front of Gabriel with inordinate care.
"What's it like to be the most famous man in Israel?" asked Sarah.
"It has its drawbacks."
"Surely it isn't all bad. Who knows? If you play your cards right, you might even be prime minister one day."
She tugged at the sleeve of his suit jacket.
"I must say you look the part. But I think I like the old Gabriel Alon better."
"Which Gabriel Alon was that?"
"The one who wore blue jeans and a leather jacket."
"We all have to change."
"I know. But sometimes I wish I could turn back the clock."
But nor was he an enemy.
"Welcome to Saudi Arabia, Director Alon. Or should I say welcome back? You're looking much better than when I saw you last."
He grasped Gabriel's hand tightly.
"I trust your wound healed well?"
"It only hurts when I laugh."
"I see you haven't lost your sense of humor."
"A man in my position needs one."
"Mine too. Business is quite brisk, as you might imagine."
The Saudi glanced at Gabriel's bodyguards.
"Are they armed?"
"Heavily."
"Please instruct them to return to the aircraft. Don't worry, Director Alon. My men will take very good care of you."
"That's what I'm afraid of."
The bodyguards reluctantly complied with Gabriel's order. A moment later, Sarah appeared in the cabin door, her blonde hair moving in the desert wind. The Saudi frowned.
I don't suppose she has a veil.
She left it in New York.
Not to worry. We brought one, just in case.
The highway was smooth as glass and black as an old vinyl record album. In press interviews in the West, Prince Khalid bin Mohammed spoke often of his reverence for the desert. He loved nothing more, he said, than to slip anonymously from his palace in Riyadh and venture alone into the Arabian wilderness. There he would establish a crude camp and engage in several days of falconry, fasting, and prayer. He would also contemplate the future of the kingdom that bore his family's name. It was during one such sojourn in the Sarawat Mountains that he conceived the way forward, his ambitious plan to remake the Saudi economy for the post-petroleum age. He claimed to have hit upon the idea of granting women the right to drive while camping in the empty quarter. Alone amid the ever-shifting dunes, he was reminded that nothing is permanent, that even in a land like Saudi Arabia, change is inevitable. The truth about KBM's desert adventures was far different. The tent into which Gabriel and Sarah were shown bore little resemblance to the camel hair shelters in which Khalid's Bedouin ancestors had dwelled. It was more like a temporary pavilion, Arab pastry while still wearing the abaya. How do they do it? They don't. They eat with other women. I'm the only one, have you noticed? There isn't another woman in this tent. I'm too busy worrying about which one is planning to kill me. Gabriel glanced at his wristwatch. Where the hell is he? Welcome to KBM time. It's 1 hour and 20 minutes later than the rest of the world. I don't like to be kept waiting. He's testing you. He shouldn't. What are you going to do, leave? Gabriel ran his palm over the silken fabric of the couch. It's not so crude, is it? You didn't really believe all that. Of course not. I'm just wondering why he bothered to say it at all. What does it matter? Because men who tell one lie usually tell others. A sudden commotion erupted among the white-robed courtiers as Crown Prince Khalid bin Mohammed entered the tent. He was dressed traditionally in a thobe and gutra, but unlike the other men, he also wore a bisht. The ransom note was 7 lines in length and rendered in English. It was accurately spelled and properly punctuated with none of the awkward wording associated with translation software. It stated that His Royal Highness Prince Khalid bin Mohammed had 10 days to abdicate and thus relinquish his claim to the throne of Saudi Arabia. Otherwise, his daughter, Princess Rima, would be put to death. The note did not specify the manner of her execution or whether it would be in accordance with Islamic law. In fact, there were no religious references at all, and none of the rhetorical flourishes common in communications from terrorist groups. On the whole, thought Gabriel, the tone was rather businesslike. When did you receive it? 3 days after Rima was taken. Long enough for the damage to be done. Unlike my father and his brothers, I have only one wife. Unfortunately, she cannot have another child. Rima is all we have. Did you show it to the French? No. I called you. Hang around Jerusalem for a day or two. You're not thinking about doing something foolish, are you?
Like what?
Making contact with Mikhail?
I wouldn't dream of it. Besides, Mikhail made it abundantly clear he's very happy with, what's her name?
Natalie.
Oh, yes, I keep forgetting.
She kissed Gabriel's cheek.
Sorry to drag you into all of this. Don't hesitate to call if there's anything more I can do.
She climbed out of the SUV without another word and disappeared through the entrance of the hotel. Gabriel dialed the operations desk at King Saul Boulevard and informed the duty officer of his intention to travel to Paris later that morning.
Anything else, boss?
Activate room 435 at the King David. Audio only. Gabriel killed the connection and leaned his head wearily against the window. She was right about one thing, he thought. The secret world was much more interesting. It was a 5-minute drive from the King David Hotel to Narcus Street, the quiet, leafy lane in the historic Jerusalem Straw. It was pale blue and plastic, the sort of thing an al-Saud never touched. They had placed it in Rima's cell after she had misbehaved during a visit to the toilet.
According to a typewritten note taped to the side, Rima was to use it until further notice. Only when her conduct returned to normal would her bathroom privileges be restored. Rima refused to relieve herself in such a shameful manner and did so on the floor of her cell instead, at which point her captors, again in writing, threatened to withhold food and water.
Fine,
Rima shouted at the masked figure who delivered the note. She would rather starve to death than eat another wretched meal that tasted as though it had been cooked in its own can. The food was not fit for pigs, let alone the daughter of the future king of Saudi Arabia. The cell was small, smaller perhaps than any room in which Rima had ever set foot. Her cot consumed most of the space. The walls were white and smooth and cold, and in the ceiling a light burned always. Rima had no concept of time, even day or night. She slept when she was tired, which was often, and dreamed of her old life. She had taken it all for granted, the unimaginable wealth and luxury, and now it was gone. They did not chain her to the floor the way they did in the American movies her father used to allow her to watch, nor did they gag her or bind her hands and feet or force her to wear a hood, only for a few hours during the long drive after she was taken. Once she was safely in the cell, they were the ones to cover their faces. There were four in all. Rima could tell them apart by their size and shape and the color of their eyes. Three were men, one was a woman. None were Arabs. Rima did her best to hide her fear, but made no attempt to conceal the fact she was bored out of her mind. She asked for a television to watch her favorite programs. Her captors in writing refused. She asked for a computer to play games or an iPod and headphones to listen to music, but again, her request was denied. Finally, she asked for a pen and a pad. Her plan was to ride a Range Rover. Rima they forced into the back of the van. They covered her head with a hood and gave her a shock to make her sleep, and when she woke, she was in the small white room. The smallest room she had ever seen in her life. But why had they abducted her? In the movies, the kidnappers always wanted money. Rima's father had all the money in the world. It meant nothing to him. He would pay the kidnappers what they wanted, and Rima would be released, and then her father would send out men to find the kidnappers and kill them all. Or perhaps her father might kill one or two himself. To Rima he was very kind, but she had heard about the things he did to people who opposed him. He would show no mercy to the people who kidnapped his only child. And so Princess Rima, bint Khalid Abdulaziz Al Saud, endured the many indignities of her captivity with as much grace as possible, secure in the knowledge she would soon be released. She ate their dreadful food without complaint and behaved herself when they took her down the darkened corridor to the toilet. After one visit, she returned to her cell